The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, providing solutions that can numbers into tangible business solutions at this year's Absa Beyond the Budget Dialogue. Now that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. It's good to have you with us. Professor Helen Rees joins us. She's the chair of the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority. Very important body. As Chinese coronavirus vaccine producer offers us access to its vaccine. And we'll talk about that, to the Sinovac biotech vaccine. They're offering it within the next couple of weeks. We'll talk to the chief executive of KPMG South Africa, Ignatius Sihole, as they try to restore the image of KPMG. Battered, of course, in the state capture allegations against it as they try to rebuild confidence in the brand of KPMG in South Africa, not helped by scandals in other parts of the world connected to KPMG either. Also, Chris Stewart this evening, our portfolio manager at 91. Results today from Nedbank and Curo. Also, an update from RMI and others. So we'll pick up on those big market moving announcements today on the JSE. Colin Cullis, just after Eyewitness News at 7, looking at the future of residential accommodation in a increasingly constrained world. And then Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, always good value from Wendy Nola as she goes down and dirty to the depths of your despair dealing with some really unfair corporate practices when it comes to dealing with customers. So we'll do all of that this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, mounting frustration at the slow pace of vaccine rollouts in South Africa's battle against COVID-19. The worry is that we get a third, possibly even a fourth wave before enough of us are vaccinated to help stem the spread of the virus. A story today that the Chinese coronavirus vaccine manufacturer Sinovac Biotech has offered to supply the government with 5 million doses of its Coronavac shot. And unlike J&J and others, they can get, the Chinese, Sinovac Biotech, can get their shot to South Africa really, really quickly. Professor Helen Rees is the chair of the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority on the line to us from Johannesburg. Should we be celebrating the possibility, Helen, of the Chinese getting us a vaccine in a matter of weeks?
Well, I mean, certainly we should be celebrating when there's any opportunity to get a vaccine that's been proven safe and effective. Because as you were saying earlier on, you know, we're in a competition with the rest of the world to try and get hold of vaccines. And that's a competition that even places like the EU is battling with. So certainly we need to look at every vaccine that's in the advanced stage of development and evaluate it. And if we find it to be safe and effective from a regulatory point of view, we should welcome any vaccine that would fall into that category.
Do we have any idea as to the quality of what is on offer here? I see it's had very different sort of outcomes in terms of the testing that was done in Brazil and testing that was done in Turkey.
Yes, and I mean, that's why the SAHPRA, the regulator, will look at all of this data. I mean, obviously, for every vaccine, these studies are being done as fast as possible. And then you've got to try and interpret the results. As you were saying, that the study, which is the phase 3 trial, where we look at safety and efficacy, does the vaccine work, was undertaken in Brazil and Turkey and Indonesia and Chile. And for the overall efficacy of the vaccine was about just over 50%. For severe disease was about 65%, but good on hospitalization and very severe disease, about 90%. And we've seen that with a lot of these vaccines, that a lot of them seem to be performing much better in terms of severe disease that ends up in hospitalization than mild to moderate disease, or disease that is not as severe as requiring ventilation, etc. So that sort of finding is not at all unusual. I mean, the numbers in that trial were smaller than in other trials, only about 13,000 5,000 people, and they had few people. They didn't have very many older people in that trial. And if I recall, and this is my memory, in their report, I don't think that they had as many women. They had many more men. So there would be obviously questions about older people and men and so on. But importantly, one other question, and we're asking this to all the vaccine manufacturers now, is what data do you have about your vaccine and our variant? Because every single vaccine that was developed for the original variant last year, we know that none of these vaccines are performing as well against the variants that that originated just before Christmas in South Africa. So we're asking every single company, can you provide us with some data on the variant? So there's a lot of questions to be asked, but we're fast-tracking all of this. And Sinovac, there have been discussions already between SAPRA and Sinovac, as they have with all of the other lead vaccines.
Yeah, because there are worries across Europe, of course, regarding AstraZeneca and whether or not the issues with clotting with the AstraZeneca vaccine that seems to be in a very small minority of cases, and worries that perhaps the Europeans are throwing the baby out of the bathwater here. We are being promised good doses of J&J and Pfizer vaccines, but these are only due later in the year. Is speed of the essence here, Helen, or is it a question of quantity, or is it a question of quality? What are the key factors we have to consider, as we really all are, I think, concerned about our access to protection against COVID-19?
And as we should be. And I think actually it's a very positive thing that people are demanding vaccines and demanding them very loudly. I mean, because we've seen in countries, for example, like France, quite a strong resistance to vaccines. So I hope that the South African population keeps that demand up. Speed is of the essence, but we also have to look at whether the vaccine is going to work in our setting, particularly with this variant, because that was the problem with AstraZeneca. If you recall, we were at the point of rolling out 1 million doses. And in the UK, it has been shown to be a very good vaccine. When we got this data, first from the lab and then combined with a very small study, which suggested that the AstraZeneca vaccine was not going to work well against mild to moderate disease. But we didn't, from that study, have any information against severe disease. But based on the lab data and that data, it was felt to be unwise to proceed in case this vaccine didn't work in the context of our variant. So yes, speed is of the essence, but we have to try and be as sure as we possibly can in the context of limited data for all of these vaccines, that this vaccine is going to work in our setting with our variant. And that's why we're asking all the companies to produce some data and pointing them in the directions of our laboratories in South Africa who can assist them with creating some of that data.
Because it'd be really self-defeating to go on this massive vaccine drive and get millions of people vaccinated, only to have them remaining pretty vulnerable still to the effects of COVID-19. One wants to do it quickly, but be as effective as possible in one's treatment or one's sort of prophylactic attempts at this stage.
Absolutely. And that's why we're asking this question to all the companies about the variants. And in fact, it's not just South Africa that's asking that question. I'm working with the World Health Organization, and the WHO is asking, and the COVAX facility. Everyone is saying, have you got data? Because, the variant has spread from us. It's now in more than 40 countries. And we're seeing variants emerging all over the world independently that have similar mutations to the ones that have occurred originally in South Africa. So in fact, for all the vaccines, for the world need, we need to make sure that these vaccines continue to be active against the variants that are emerging. And we're starting to be able to have some sort of sense of what is likely to emerge and what we need to tackle. So that is absolutely a critical, critical question. And then if I have this discussion with you in 6 months' time, I'll probably be talking to you about, do we need booster doses? Can we mix one vaccine with another vaccine? And all of that work is ongoing as well to try and develop the most effective schedules of vaccines, either by having boosters of the same vaccine or even combining two different vaccines. All of that work is going on in the background.
Thank you, Professor Helen Rees, who is chair of the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority. Piece of good news out today. The stuff's available. We can get it quickly, more quickly than we can get hold of other products from the likes of J&J and Pfizer. The question is, of course, efficacy, and the question is safety. All of these issues which Helen Rees and her colleagues are seeking to resolve as soon as they possibly can.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
We see KPMG continuing in its efforts to restore its public image. They've entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Association for the Advancement of Black Accountants of South Africa. And they say they want to help the accounting profession transform. KPMG, you will remember, is at the forefront of allegations of state capture, allegations of complicity when it came to the collapse of the efficacy of SARS, and of course with VBS Mutual Bank. Ignatius Sehule is the chief executive of KPMG South Africa. I mean, is this I think is hopefully more than just a PR exercise, Ignatius, to try and restore your company's fortunes.
Good evening, Bruce, and to your listeners. The new KPMG does not get involved in things that are just of pure PR exercise. You may or may not know that the new vision of the new KPMG is to be the most trusted and trustworthy professional services firm. So we only say and do what we mean, and we live by our values all the time.
So what are you hoping to achieve by this partnership with the Association of Black Accountants?
Exactly what you said, Bruce. Bruce, we hope to be able to deepen and broaden the development of and growth of small black firms. We hope with this project to give them access to complex assignments that they otherwise wouldn't have access to. Through us, they will work with us on our assignments and get the knowledge that they can take back to their firms to be able to drive development of their own firms and the growth of their own firms.
A couple of weeks ago, you told us that you wouldn't be doing any sort of consulting to audit clients listed on the JSE. How has that gone down in amongst your clients?
It's gone down very well, Bruce. It was welcomed by a lot of our clients. It was welcomed by regulators, as you might expect. All around, there's been quite some. Welcoming thumbs up from our stakeholders.
Are you seeing a flow in new business coming in to KPMG South Africa? Are you signing new clients?
Yes, Bruce, we are signing new clients. I haven't actually counted them, but we have signed up well over 15, 20 clients since I joined the firm. And the count is continuing every day. So yes, we are happy to say that what we are doing at KPMG is being appreciated by our clients and prospective clients, and that's why we're getting more new clients. I think if we weren't practicing what we're saying we're doing, we wouldn't be getting clients at the rate that we are. Our regulators have also come to see for themselves, and they're quite happy with what they see.
What about the potential of future prosecutions, the future investigations into KPMG complicity in a multitude of issues, which of course brought the reputation of the company or the partnership come crashing down over the last 5 or 6 years? Where are we in those potential prosecutions?
We've had a summons issued to us by the liquidator of VBS, and if you remember way back when Advocate Motau issued his report, the so-called Motau report, one of the recommendations was for the bank to try and recover some of the money from KPMG. So it is something that we have been expecting because, as I say, it was in the report. And yes, the summons have arrived, and it's now in front of the court, and we're dealing with it. That's the only one that is on the cards right now.
Thank you, Ignatius Ohule, who is the chief executive of KPMG South Africa. Lovely story. Lovely, clever, smart branding exercise. Oh, you got to love it when companies think laterally. Barilla. These are guys who make pasta. You see their pasta comes in boxes, blue boxes, red logo. You've seen it on the shelf at your local ShopRite or Checkers or Pick and Pay. It's all there. But Barilla's teamed up with Spotify. This is the music streaming app. And if you want to know how long to cook pasta for and you want to get it absolutely right, what Barilla have done with Spotify is they've curated a number of playlists that pair up depending on the type of pasta that you are cooking. And the idea is that once your water pot is boiling, you add that particular pasta to the water. You then push play on the corresponding playlist, knowing that penne will cook at a different rate to spaghetti, which will cook at a different rate to linguine. And you can then just bop along to the music. And when that particular playlist is done, it means that your pasta is done too. It's a fabulous idea.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Well, a trading update from Grand Parade Investments today, the company that operates Burger King in South Africa, seeing considerably lower in-store foot traffic. But this is the interesting bit. The fact that there was a massive fall-off in foot traffic, it was offset by significant growth in home delivery. They actually achieved 1.7% growth in comparative sales for the 6 months to the end of December 2020. Their margins, though, were lower. So they're not making as much money on every burger that they produced. But the point is they're managing to get their burgers into the hands of their customers. And their margins lower due to the fact that the sales mix did shift towards home delivery. So there's increased food costs and once-off costs and lots of COVID-19 operating procedures. But so they made less money. But the point is, they didn't fall in a heap. Chris Stewart, he's a portfolio manager at 91. The banking sector hasn't fallen in a heap either. It's a small pile, but not a heap. They've come under a lot of pressure, Chris Stewart, but my goodness me, it's nothing like it was in 2008.
Yeah, Bruce, I mean, the banking sector, I think if one looks back at 2020, has done remarkably well, possibly not getting enough credit for having done as well as they have. They've thus far navigated a real minefield with regard to credit quality. They've aggressively built provisions, and that's obviously resulted in earnings being materially negatively impacted. But they've also had to take organizations of 30 or 40,000 employees, running IT call centers, running collections call centers, running a branch network of 700-800 branches across the country, and entirely repurpose that to deliver financial services to their clients in a manner that keeps their clients safe, keeps their customers and staff safe, and also meets the desire to start to transact according to different channels to what we've seen historically. I mean, people are ordering burgers online and getting them at home. People are logging onto their banking apps where previously they might have nipped down to the branch down the road. And what's going to be really interesting to see over the next number of years is how much of the behavioral change that's been forced upon us by COVID. I'm not sitting in your studio now. I'm sitting at home in my study talking to a computer screen. How much of that sort of behavior is in fact going to become entrenched and going to materially change the way we do things in the future on a permanent basis? And as a result of that, force corporates to rethink their delivery channels, their delivery strategy, in order to really leapfrog what might otherwise have been a multi-year transition towards where we've ended up already.
And then Rand Merchant Insurance, they are a much smaller entity than they were previously. They've unbundled a whole bunch of businesses. What else is in RMI?
Well, RMI sits with... they've got a couple of stakes in listed entities, so they've still got shares in Discovery. They've still got a stake in Momentum Metropolitan, both of whom we have already seen the results from in the last couple of weeks. Then they've got a significant stake in OUTsurance, which is the pred- predominantly still short-term insurance business in South Africa and Australia. And then they also have a stake in Hastings, which they've taken on board relatively recently, Hastings being a short-term insurance business in the United Kingdom.
Okay. And I mean, the performance is okay. I mean, it's financial services, so coming under pressure. Are they outperforming the other in sort of investment entity, which is Remgro? Remgro also had a trading update today.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, if you look at what's going on at RMI, you know, we've seen the results out of Momentum. We've seen the results out of Discovery, both of those businesses in the life insurance sector that have been struggling. No real surprise in this kind of environment. And they've really just been, again, similar to the banks battening down the hatches in order to preserve capital and try and make life as easy as possible for their clients and deal with a disproportionate claims experience as a consequence of COVID and all things COVID-related. The short-term insurance businesses, ironically, as we've seen across the country, have, by and large, outside of business interruption claims, found that life has been a little bit better than typically the case during 2020. People have been traveling less. If you don't get into your car, you don't tend to have an accident. Crime rates in terms of break-ins, houses, that sort of thing have been down as well. So underwriting margins have been pretty good. And within our assurance, we've seen robust top-line rates of growth. They continue to grow the business, gain market share, and you know, have experienced reasonably decent underwriting results over the period. Remgro has materially changed spots. If you look at Remgro's trading update out today for the 6 months to December of 2020, let's just give them a little bit of credit and remember that that's a six-month period that's entirely post-COVID, being compared to a six-month period that is entirely pre-COVID. They're talking headline earnings per share down 60 to 70%, and even on a continuing operations basis, down 45 to 55%, continuing operations stripping out RMH, because RMH, Rand Merchant Bank Holdings, was unbundled from Remgro effective June last year. So that's not in the current period, but was in the prior year period. So they've stripped that out. Even stripping that out, headline earnings per share down 45 to 55%. Three big drivers there. One is Mediclinic's contribution to their earnings. They have a large stake in Mediclinic. We know the hospital group's pressure earnings have been under significant pressure due to the fact that COVID capacity has eaten up a lot of the capacity they would have otherwise had for higher margin elective procedures. And people who might have elected to go into hospital to have something done, they've said, you know what, I'm going to postpone it because a hospital is somewhere I really don't want to be right now. So Mediclinic struggled, and that's fed through into Remgro. First Rand, where Remgro own a stake, they have changed the accounting classification of First Rand from an equity accounted, they would have brought through the earnings of First Rand to an investment held at fair value through profit and loss. All very boring. The bottom line is they're not equity accounting any earnings from First Rand. That only account for dividends. And as we know, none of the banks have been paying dividends over the period. So no income coming in from First Rand. And the last point is Remgro does sit on a fairly large cash pile. And anybody who sits with savings in the bank right now knows that you're earning a lot less interest on it now than you were 6 to 12 months ago. And that's also hit Remgro's earnings contribution.
Yeah, at some point, they have to apply that cash somewhere. Well, we wait for that day. Before I ask you about the Fed, just a quick one. Eskom, oh, look, up to stage two load shedding again from 9 o'clock tonight till 5 o'clock on Saturday. Stage one, of course, happened this time yesterday. Didn't think it was going to last, and it hasn't. More power stations have broken down. US Fed tonight, a bit more predictable perhaps than Eskom?
Well, you hope so. I hope so. Most things are more predictable than Eskom right now. We would hope that the Fed perhaps smooth troubled waters a little bit. We've seen a little bit of market nervousness about the projection, the future projection of short-term interest rates in the United States. We've seen the U.S. 10-year bond sell off a little bit, yields going north of the 1.6% range. That started to get equity markets and risk markets a little bit uncomfortable. We'd like to see the Fed saying, guys, there's no real inflationary problems out there. We still have substantial excess capacity in the economy. We're still much more worried about growth. Monetary accommodation will persist. And don't worry, we're not going to increase interest rates anytime over the next couple of years. Get the market calmed down. get those bond yields back down again, and then it can be game on at the equity markets again, Bruce.
Thank you, Chris Stewart, Portfolio Manager at 91.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Unpacking data-driven insights and analysis to turn numbers into tangible business solutions at this year's Absa Beyond the Budget Dialogue. Now that's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Mike Brown, Chief Executive at Nedbank, standing by. We'll chat to him in a moment. We'll also talk to the CEO of Curo in this half hour, followed after Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock with Colin Cullis and Business Unusual. Coming up on the next Money Show, personal finance expert Warren Ingram getting his teeth into the performance of the stock market versus that of the economy, explaining why it is that the stock market is hitting record highs, but the economy is not. In fact, it's hitting record lows. Pablo Fatidis with Small Business and Nick Haralambos, tips for your side hustles and how to get money for those side hustles next time on the Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
Welcome to the Money Show this evening. Mike Brown is the Chief Executive at Nedbank. And the biggest difference between this global recession that we're going through at the moment, triggered by a health crisis, rather than the previous international catastrophe, which was sparked by rubbish loans and shocking management of bank loans around the world, is that there's been very little talk of a financial system collapse this time around. Sure, the banks have taken a lot of pain, but it's been considerably less scary. Mike Brown, Chief Executive of Nedbank. Would you concur with that, Mike?
Bruce, hi, good evening, and good evening, everybody. Absolutely, Bruce. I did a whole host of interviews in the second quarter of this year where I did point out how fortunate we were that the banking system went into this crisis from a position of strength and that I fully expected it to remain resilient. And with the benefit of hindsight, I think the system got the balance right between helping clients and customers in their time of need, but ensuring that the safety and soundness of the system was never, ever at risk.
Because, I mean, profits have been pulverized. There's no question about it. Yours are down about 56%. APSA's by a similar amount. Your clients in personal and business life have taken considerable strain. And it's been a case of really, I suppose, life support for the economy through the crisis.
Yeah, it's been extremely difficult for many, many people. A health and economic crisis in statistical terms, from a banking point of view, it's a 1-in-100-year event. We also now have, you know, much more forward-looking and dynamic provisioning rules in place, something called IFRS 9, which requires us to raise provisions a whole bunch earlier than what would have happened in the previous cycle. But notwithstanding all of that, you know, the system remained soundly profitable, albeit at lower levels, well-capitalized and liquid.
I mean, you just went into banking results speak there, but I mean, it's a case of saying you take provisions. In other words, you anticipate that things could continue to be pretty awful. And if they're not, well, then you simply undo those provisions at a later date. And theoretically, that then, you know, helps you restore profitability later on in the banking cycle.
That's correct. And obviously, we have our models of what we think the economy is going to do in the year ahead, how we think the virus will progress. And off the back of that, you know, we think that bad debts in 2021 will be lower than 2020. And in fact, in 2020, you know, our bad debt charge, something we call the credit loss ratio, which is for every 100 Rand you lend out, you know, what are you providing in bad debts? In the first half of the year, that was about 1.9%. In the second half of the year, 1.3% to average 1.6 for the full year. So we would expect that in the year ahead to be somewhere in the 1.1 to 1.3% range, which does mean that we think the worst for bad debts is behind us, not in front of us.
And that's good news. I mean, because it does suggest that you're anticipating a recovery in the underlying economy. What have been the standout issues for you in terms of this crisis? What has been really, really hard to manage?
Well, I think it's absolutely incredible to think how we went almost exactly a year ago from, yeah, you know, a bank with 30,000 people in branches, in campuses, et cetera, to, you know, probably 2 weeks later, 80% of all staff working from home and still being able to keep, you know, almost 100% uptime and serving customers. And it was in that environment that really for us, keeping staff safe and healthy and helping customers in their time of need was much more important than profitability. So for me, the amazing job that our staff did in helping our clients and customers was the absolute standout feature of 2020, and you know, really pleasing to see for Nedbank that we've had great increases in customer satisfaction and net promoter scores in the recent surveys, now putting us at number 2 on both of those in South Africa.
How does this change the way Nedbank operates into the future? I mean, is there a fundamental shift, or do we gradually go back to the way things were at some point in the future?
I think we were always on the progression of a fundamental shift to a more digital banking environment, particularly in the higher volume retail environments, less so perhaps in the CIB, more customized, you know, face-to-face intellectual capital businesses. And certainly what COVID has done for all of us is accelerated that. So, you know, I don't think we're going back to the old normal. I don't think anybody knows quite what the new normal might be, but it's definitely much more digital and less physical than it was.
And that then means fewer branches into the future, or certainly smaller branches, smaller points of presence, a fundamental shift in the purpose of the branch into the future. I mean, already there's been a downscaling across the industry of branches and branch networks and changing the way all of that works. But, I mean, this has got to be a fundamental strategy, one would think, into the future.
Absolutely. If you dig around in the detail of our results, we talk about a program called Target Operating Model. And one of the big pieces of that target operating model is continually right-sizing our physical footprint to match the changing behavior of our customer base. And you know, if we just look at you know, anything in 2020 that showed double-digit growth had to do with digital. The volumes on our money app was up 70%. The values was up 53%. Digitally active clients up 25%. So you know, we think that trend will continue, supported by the significant investments that Nedbank has made in technology over the last few years.
You must remember, I suppose you look at it, you realize just how much money you would have had to spend on marketing to get people to change their habits the way they have. And by being forced to do so, you know, this crisis has done the job for you in terms of transforming your clients into more digital citizens.
It's definitely accelerated that, because at the same time, you know, we now have digital products and services available that we didn't previously. So you could do lots of things on your mobile phone previously, but for Nedbank, you couldn't, for example, take out a personal loan, a credit card, investment. Those were not digitized. We've now digitized 5 of our top 10 product journeys, and we'll finish the other 5 in the next year or so. And we've now digitized nearly 170 services. So you really can do absolutely everything you need to do with your bank on your mobile device.
Talk to me about the fact that South African banks, including yourselves, are now bigger holders of bonds, South African government bonds, than you were before this crisis. You've become, along with the Reserve Bank, buyers of, I suppose you're buyers of second last resort and the Reserve Bank buyer of last resort when it comes to government bonds. And there's been quite a big sell-off recently. It's all well and good, one would think, for now. But if we go back to a period of, and we hope it never happens, a Zuma 2.0, if you like, a second version of a Zuma administration, what does that do in terms of the stability of the banking system, the stability of the country?
So, you know, clearly that's something that everybody is very focused on. And, you know, interestingly, the genesis of all of that was the global financial crisis and the rules that were written by Basel post that, around things like liquidity coverage ratios and the requirements for high-quality liquid assets. So essentially, the global financial crisis drove regulation to require banks to have much higher levels of liquidity, and what qualified as liquidity was government stock. So it reinforced that feedback loop between banks and their sovereigns. From a Nedbank point of view, we have increased our holding of government stock. Some of that was a switch out of shorter-dated treasury bills into longer-dated government stock. So the same credit risk, but just longer duration, driven by the fact that we've got such a steep yield curve. So you can earn higher yields, you know, in the 5 to 10 year point of the curve than the 3 to 6 month point of the curve. And so some of it was driven by that. But also, we've continued to grow deposits quite strongly in this environment. with fewer lending opportunities. So one of the sort of consequences of so-called crowding out is that one of the better places for us to put that surplus liquidity is in government stock until such time as we find better client lending opportunities.
Yeah, and that all depends on economic growth. Talk to me briefly about the dealings Nedbank had with Regiments Capital. This was a big story about a month ago. You chose at that point not to discuss the issue publicly. Talk to me about the position that Nedbank found itself in with Regiments Capital, because you were in a fairly profitable and quite long-lasting relationship with Regiments Capital, which later became quite discredited as a result of state capture in the Guptas.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. I'll spend a bit of time on this. And we did release a statement straight after the article that you spoke about. But before I get into it, I mean, there are really three things I want to talk about. Firstly, Nedbank's stance on state capture and corruption. And we have absolutely zero tolerance for that. And we expect our staff, clients, and service providers to conduct themselves with integrity. And I think if you look at Nedbank's history in terms of the organizations we've participated in, we've been at the forefront of pushing back against state capture. I think secondly, what's really important is the detailed forensic reviews that we've done on all of these transactions before any article was released. We did extensive internal forensic investigations. So, you know, think about cloning people's computers, think about interviewing people, listening to every single call in the dealing room, etc. And then in respect of one set of transactions around Transnet, we had external legal review our internal forensic investigation. And the real important things were, all of those found no evidence of Nedbank or Nedbank staff, dishonesty, corruption, collusion, or breaches of law. And at the time of entering into these transactions, no reason to suspect corrupt behavior by regiments or their staff. All these transactions are governed by normal documentation, and our pricing and returns were reasonable for the risks that were assumed. So there was no excess profitability. The last thing that's very important is the time periods here. So we had an agreement with regiments called an Introduction to Derivatives Agreement. That lasted for 2009 to 2011. Three clients were transacted with under that, and there was no more transactions after 2011 other than the payment of any fees due from transactions prior to 2011.
Okay.
And certainly in South Africa in 2011, there was no conversation around state capture or regiments involvement therein. And then the Transnet deals were done in 2015 and 16. Those, no fees were paid to regiments by Nedbank, and they've been fully investigated by the Zondo Commission. So for me, you know, it's simply not true to say that Nedbank knowingly was complicit with regiments in state capture.
Did you share this information with Amabungani? Because at some point you stopped communicating with them, and that led to them publishing a report which was severely damaging to the reputation of Nedbank.
Yeah, so we certainly did share some information with them. It's very difficult to share all the information with journalists, given that a lot of it has client privilege attached to it, or to the extent that it's contained in affidavits to the Zondo Commission. We're not sure yet whether those affidavits have been published. So we certainly tried to cooperate as far as we could, but it got to a stage where, you know, we kind of felt we were just getting asked so many questions it didn't feel like it was going anywhere, and, you know, we couldn't respond anymore.
Okay. Mike Brown, thank you. Chief Executive at Nedbank.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
You wouldn't have thought that you'd see queues around the block for private schools, but certainly Curro has had an uptick in demand. Andries Grelin, Chief Executive at Curro. You've seen a 9% increase at the start of this year for children wanting to get into private schooling, Andries. What do you attribute that to?
Hi, Bruce. I think it's many factors. If you go back to the beginning of last year, we also had a good growth, growing to over 63,000 learners, and then saw the decline now predominantly in our preschools for the last part of 2020. But I think out of this thing that happened in COVID, you know, over the years, we invested heavily in our IT infrastructures, and we were one of the first groups that moved into robotics and bringing in IT in our curriculum and coding and drone. So, and we trained our teachers in using up Microsoft Teams, etc. So when lockdown happened, I think the market realized the quality of our offering. We continue to try and keep learners entertained with esports and cultural activities happening virtually. It ended off with a brilliant Red Star result. We are both IB learners and our national exam learners, which is one academies in Amarillo, and are seeing brilliant results, the best ever. So I think all of that culminated in a brand that got known in a short space of time, which we are really thankful for.
I mean, when you look at it, 65,000 children in the Curo system, is that a record number?
This is ours. We are 66,000. So we plan to, you know, when we many years ago said we want to get to 80 campuses, but the way that we open a campus will only be up till grade 8, starting in grade 9, 10, 11, and 12, as you know, in the following years, and as there is a demand. So you grow basically two ways. You grow in your entry points in grade 1, and then in grade 8, and then obviously as the rollover into the new grades happen. So only about 50% of our schools already reach grade 12. So, you know, if you look at our grade 8 intake for this year, we're standing at about 6,200 learners, which is the highest ever compared to about 3,000 in grade 12. So,
this largely due to government schools are operating sort of one day on, one day off in some cases? They were very, very slow to get back in the new year. Parents just losing faith in the public system?
I think it's part of public and private, and when we analyze our results, maybe quality on the private side also got an issue. But I think if you look at specifically the high school demand and predominantly English education, there's a huge demand. I think parents know that they need to prepare their child in English for tertiary education. And then, you know, you start looking around for quality and affordability. And you get stuck somewhere. And I think then obviously Kiddo becomes preferred supplier.
Andries Greiling, Chief Executive at Curo Holdings. Share price a fraction of what it used to be. Multiple a lot more attractive. Building a real business for the future as parents worry about the future of education for their kids.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, providing solutions that can numbers into tangible business solutions at this year's Absa Beyond the Budget Dialogue. Now that's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. Colin Cullis standing by. Big trends in city developments. This idea of micro apartments. How would you feel about living in a micro apartment? Colin's been tweeting about it this evening. And we'll talk about this trend. Wendy Nola, should you be a loyal customer? This idea, I think it's quite antiquated. I'm a loyal customer. I've been your customer for 20 years. Why do you treat me like I'll be here forever? It's because you do. You behave like that. And, we're talking about being a loyal customer and whether or not you're the sucker in the loyal customer arrangement. Is there place for anything such as a loyal customer anymore? If you are in a company that values loyal customers, I'd love to hear from you this evening because you may be the exception that proves the rule. But we'll look at that in some detail tonight with Wendy Nola. And then Ndabe Mkize, chairman at IG Markets South Africa, talked to him about life in corporate. That is all coming up this evening as our shapeshifter at 7:30.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
With Colin Cullis.
Micro apartments, Colin Cullis. I mean, what is a micro apartment? I've seen a microwave. I've seen a micro leaf salad. A micro apartment, tiny, tiny, tiny. How big is tiny?
It's tiny, Bruce. And I guess it's in that long tradition of realtors having all sorts of interesting terminology and jargon to help better position things. You know, the old double story. As in one story before you buy the place and another one after you bought it. Well, the micro apartments and the tiny homes are not a new movement, but they've been, I'd say, gaining a little bit of pace, certainly here in South Africa. A couple of years ago, there were these super experimental, will it work kind of ideas. This year, there's three or four very large ones. And the traction and the seeming rate of the sales suggests that, one, there is a market. Two, the market is willing to pay. And seemingly, and this, I suppose, where the experiment is still out in the field, can we live in homes where tiny home, typically 40 square meters, or these micro apartments could be as small as 25 square meters? And the reason for them coming about is not crazy. To use Mark Twain's old line, you know, buy land, they don't make it anymore. It's simply a component of there being a lot more of us, and certainly for the spaces where people want to live, you know, the demand and the supply is going to dictate what you can get for a rental, and certainly what you can make if you were to sell a property. So the idea of developers looking for sometimes old office buildings, sometimes just old apartment buildings and converting it, or just raising the things to the ground and rebuilding brand new blocks that are built with a super dense residential units, but mixed in with the sort of co-living spaces. And we touched on this co-living idea some time back. At the time, though, it was looking to try and address urban city living becoming less social. People would sort of just stick to their houses, go to their work, and, you know, stuck in their cars. And it was a way to try and make people interact a little more, as well as a way for dealing, certainly in cities that have got much older populations, for keeping an older generation in touch with the younger generation and avoiding getting the sort of elements of loneliness, etc. Well, this is almost the same thing, but aimed at the other side of the segment. Younger people looking to move out of home, move closer to work, benefit from living in a nice, vibrant city, but simply not having the funds to be able to afford it, or having to use so much of their income for their accommodation, they've effectively got very little or nothing left for anything else, or are compelled to have to live in places that seriously those landlords should have big fingers pointed at them for what they're willing to do for their tenants. And then the other alternative is people looking to find something that is as close as possible to work or the city centres, but not that close, requiring commutes, in which case you're simply moving the cost for the rental into the cost for car ownership or the cost for transport and all of the time delay and pollution and congestion that comes with it. So I don't think I have to paint more of the problem to suggest that we certainly are in need of a solution. And one of them put forward by some, simply saying, well, let's give it a try. By others, hardcore activists saying, this is a no-brainer. And quite honestly, we've been kidding ourselves, thinking there's enough space for everybody to live in very large spaces, would see that the time is now right for us to begin to do this. In fact, let me give you a little clip from one of these tiny home activists. His name's Andrew Morrison. For very many years, he's been both extolling the virtues of living in the small house he has. And he isn't, you know, living on his own. Often these small homes are focused on people who live alone or very young couples, you know, just started going out, just got married, in which case you can still get by in a very small space. He has been living in a home for quite some time. It's not in a busy urban setting. It's in a slightly more rural setting, but allows him to not take up too much space. So it's very, very much an environmental thing. And I think he has an 11-year-old daughter that stays in this really small house with him. But here's his take on the costs of ownership of big houses, not just in terms of money, but in terms of time.
So somehow we were told that bigger is better, when I really think that bigger means you have less time, you're spending more money, and there's more stress involved. So there are lots of costs that come into it. And again, I'm going to go back to the U.S. averages before I get to the cost of, well, I've already spoken about some financial costs. So we'll talk about other costs like time. So let's say you've, you know, dedicated 27% of your time and you're gonna go to work and you're gonna do that and come back and there goes that money, it's gone, right? You have to get to and from work and there's often traffic involved, especially here in the Springs. So if you're looking at the average commute, you're looking about an hour, okay? That's round trip. And each person typically in the US works about an 8.5-hour day, including lunch and breaks. That means of the 24 hours in a day, you're not even in your house for 9.5 of them. So add in how much we all sleep. How much do you guys think we sleep? Like 5-6 hours a night? Kind of feels like that sometimes. It's actually 9 hours. It's the US average. So if you add up the amount that you're asleep and the amount that you're gone, it means that you're left with about 5.5 hours awake in your house during the day, during the work week. So I personally hope that you're doing a really, really good job with those 5.5 hours and that you're using them really well, because that's expensive. If you amortize the cost of your house over 5.5 hours, that's a lot.
It's such a good... A huge point that he makes. Now, I mean, not everybody's idea of living in 25 square meters with a partner and a child is, it's not everybody's idea of fun. But it does come down to design. It does come down to the elements that you put into these places, because really smart design, and having visited friends in other parts of the world who do live in tiny apartments, I mean, 25 square meters is, I think, fairly normal in some urban city centers in Europe, for example. You manage because you've got floor-to-ceiling cupboards. You've got lots of space, storage space, smart bathrooms, smart kitchens, you know, foldable tables and chairs, all sorts of really clever innovations that happen. And I think we would have a lot to do on the design front in South Africa, because we're used to sort of kind of throwing up buildings and not particularly thinking brilliantly about how we structure the living in those spaces, pretty much.
That's a key part, Bruce. And I think even though South Africa is still way behind the sort of design thinking and construction sort of thinking that they have in Europe, the bonus is it's all been done. We simply have to bring it in. So whether that come to insulation to make living in such close proximity to somebody who's literally one wall away from you, the insulation has advanced to the point where you probably won't hear them. Cooling and heating and just ventilation, because if you're that close to your bathroom, there's obviously certain downsides that come with inefficient ventilation. But the point is they've managed to solve a lot of those things. And like you say, the smart kitchens, single appliances that can do multiple forms of cooking as opposed to requiring, you know, one appliance for each of these things is a massive advantage. And the big one for me, high-speed internet, big telly on the wall, and basically you're living in a cinema. And, you know, you don't really have much need to have to go out if you just want to relax. And again, if those 5 hours is why you're there, then you can make the most of them. But for the rest of the time, and this is the other real clever thing about how they built it, they didn't just say, let's stick a whole bunch of small apartments into a block and be done with it. They have built all of these other co-living spaces that in any other event, you'd never have access to. So you could never afford a swimming pool if you bought a small house or you live in a small apartment. But if you live in one of these micro apartments, the building, the block, can afford to pay to have a pool person look after the pool and make it available all the time, and a gym, and a restaurant, concierges, even some of them have a sort of entertainment managers who will arrange social events and book calendar events to have people, one, get to know each other, which again, if you are living there on your own, great way to meet people and form new friendships, possibly romantic ones, but otherwise just to keep things ticking over. And once again, there was one that I came across that simply said, we don't sell parking. We just don't think a building, for its location, it's slap bang in the middle of the city, you should be concerned with the car. Walk to where you need to get to, and we've thought about everything you might need. It's in walking distance. And for anything else, a short Uber drive. And Uber themselves have stated that their ideal was to make using Ubers so cheap that it would be less than having to own a car. And again, the congestion, the parking, all of that sort of stuff actually does make sense. So for all of those reasons, it's a pretty good idea. However, getting South Africans to accept it, well, let me say getting 702 at Cape Talk listeners to accept it, that might be a little harder. I asked in a poll just ahead of the show, what sort of how small could you go? And the number one, 64% said they're not going under 100 square meters, which is not an insubstantial flat as it goes. Some said, 25% said they draw the line at 50 square meters. 10% said they could handle 25 square meters. And nobody said that they were prepared to go less than 25 square meters. I watched a video recently of a woman living in Japan. She had an 8-square-meter apartment, kitchen, bathroom, bedroom. That was really kind of pushing the boat out. But that's how small it can go. And again, with very clever designs, et cetera. And if you're super close to other amenities and places to entertain friends, et cetera, then it's not necessarily, you know, too much of a hassle. I've got a couple of pros and cons. I don't think it's too hard to consider these.
Pros, absolutely. But just before you do that, I mean, for the vast majority of South Africans, a 25-meter square, really well-designed, dignified space would be really good as a way to enter a property market, for example.
Yeah, in fact, the pros and cons I'll leave online, because I think that's the key thing. Owning a home isn't just like an economic useful thing to have. It's a dream for a lot of people. But seriously, once you've managed to get your foot on the ladder, as it were, and it's not so it's so difficult for you to pay off those bonds, then you're more likely to get to a position where the equity for the home is going to allow you to get a bigger bond. It's going to allow you to pay the bond off sooner, so you'll be able to afford something a little bigger, which means you get moving up to the point where when you're ready to start a family, when you'd like to have somewhere with a little more space and, you know, can have a pet without feeling guilty about it, you're in a position to do so. So this does seem like a very useful sort of bridging idea to not just say, well, rely on rich parents or tough luck. It does have some questions, though, for, you know, South Africa doesn't just have a problem with not enough of small size units. We've got a real problem with how do we handle social housing? And I try to find some options to see, can it answer this sort of question? And the answer, the short answer seems to be no, because typically social housing is needed for larger family units, multi-generational sort of families, relatives, etc. So you can't really say, oh, well, separate everybody out or squeeze you all into 25 square meters. But it may be possible under certain circumstances that multiple units could be allocated. I think what's more practical, though, is that in any of these residential setups, a certain number of units must be set aside and on a lottery basis or on a rental control basis made available to people who otherwise wouldn't qualify. Sort of start adding the opportunity for some more people to get access to this that otherwise wouldn't, and start slowly closing that gap, as it were. But then the other caution I would give is, you know, speculators coming in here, driving up the cost to make them unaffordable again, hoping for a quick buck a year or two down the line, pushing up the rentals to make them inaffordable, not looking after the premises and having nobody want to live there is a big problem. Similarly, they're great little Airbnb units. You imagine a lot of people saying, great, get this thing, make a lot on the short-term rentals. But once again, as we saw during the pandemic, terrible time if you're reliant on that. And Cape Town itself has had a sort of an oversupply recently with people buying for that reason. So there are as many downsides as there are upsides, and that's the case with most things. I think as a concept, it's a very good one. Is it going to be disruptive? I think it will. But like most disruptions, they disrupt the part of the market that needed the disruption. They cut away the deadwood and allow for something new to be developed. They don't kill old things. They're not going to stop people wanting to have a lovely home or a bit of space around them. And in that case, I think it's wonderful that we can start talking about them and making more of these things available to South Africans.
Colin Cullis with Business Unusual this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Wendy Nola is our Consumer Ninja, and it's all about customer loyalty. Are you one of those people, Wendy, who is a loyal customer? You've been banking with the same bank for 50 years. You've been 40 years, of course, 40 years. You've been banking, you've been driving the same brand of car. You have been dealing with the same insurance company because you believe that loyalty matters. Loyalty counts.
No, I mean, I have been with the same bank for I don't know how many decades, but, you know, I think it's more sort of convenient and they aren't that bad for me to, you know, make the big moves and deal with all my debit orders and all that sort of thing. And car, yes, I'm really loyal to one particular brand for good reason. So I work with an insurer, a direct insurer, for something like 15 years. And me, the consumer journalist, I thought I was doing the right things, you know, challenging them when they wanted to do the annual increases and all that. But actually, our premium on car and household goods was becoming less and less competitive as the years went by. I didn't do my proper, you know, checks to see that they'd been okay with very few claims I'd made. But, you know, I didn't check that the premium I was paying was properly competitive. And then when I found out, made the calls, I was horrified. And they wanted to slash mine down. I said, no, I'm totally grumpy and disillusioned with you that you would do that to me, this loyal customer. Go away. And I went and switched to someone else. And I get this from people a lot. So I'm always saying, you have to be on top of these things. You have to keep making sure you have a competitive rate, because the business model is they lure the new people with lovely advertising campaigns and lovely premiums, because they're getting the fat from the loyal ones who for years and years just carry on paying and don't challenge. And then I had an email from Anton of Joburg, Bruce, who has been a loyal customer of Tracker, the car tracking company, for more than a decade. He said when he discovered by chance, chatting to a mate who had got this package for his daughter, that the most expensive package that the company was offering was 190 rand per month, and he's currently paying 322 rand a month. And he says, I wasn't even on the top package. When I called the call center to look into this, I was told, oh, with annual escalations for when I joined, and now on a month-to-month contract. He then said, well, I want to move on a new package the new package, thank you, at 190 rand a month, and he was moved over, just like that. So that's a saving of over 100 rand. And he said, I find this immoral because I was effectively penalized for being a loyal customer for 10 years. Yeah. I understand legally I have no legal standard, but shouldn't Tracker be contacting the existing customers if they change their products and their costs? And the answer is no. You don't ask, you don't get. So I did ask Tracker for a comment. And I said, you know, this is not unique to Tracker by any means. It's common. You do get that to the layperson who discovers this, they feel that their loyalty is being punished as Bantam. And it feels like they've been kicked in the teeth, right? The response was, Tracker structures its pricing in line with its commercial model, which is based, listen to this, over the expected longevity of a customer for a specific service. So in other words, you start off cheap and then to make our business work, we've got to keep making you less competitive. So the customer can expect to pay the lowest price at the start of a contract with annual increases based on inflation-related rates. But you'd think the original premium, and the premium now for new customers is linked to inflation, and what I mean, it's relevant for that moment, right? Annual increases are not a fixed percentage each year, varying according to the market, the economy, etc. And all services are reviewed and pricing kept depending on the services customers subscribe. Once the subscription price is kept, no further increase will be applied. They didn't address the whole issue about loyalty being punished, but they were saying that you can buy it upfront, which I strongly advocate that you pay the upfront price for the actual tracking device rather than build it into a three-year contract, because you can cancel in at any time. And I have so many people writing daily, Bruce, saying, I saw the car, but I'm still being charged, but, you know, the premium every month. Well, because you signed a three-year contract, doesn't matter what happened to the thing, you're still liable.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so basically, you know, Tracker says we do everything in the belief the company's making real difference in South Africa. We strive to keep the subscription rate a cost as low as possible.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Okay,
but
here's the point, is you need to be in charge of your personal financial affairs. You need to be on top of it. And it's a pain and it's boring. And it's like the I like my dentist, but other than going to the dentist for a big filling, maybe even a root canal, this is the last thing you want to do. I mean, it's tedious, but I mean, just this guy, your friend Anton of Joburg, saving more than, you know, saving 1,500 rand a year.
Exactly. I don't know. 190 to 322, you know me in maths, Bruce, but that is significant over a month and certainly over the year, as you say. Make sure you either get the competitive quote and say you drop it, please, or I'm moving, or you move. But, you know, I think, you're overpaying, basically. You don't have to be part of their business model in terms of, you know, you've been with them for ages and now you're paying a really uncompetitive rate.
When particularly when it comes to something like insurance, and you go to your insurance broker and you say, "Hi, could I please get a better rate? Because we've had this discussion before. I've owned my car for X number of years. You now charge me twice as much as you did at the start of our relationship, and the car is worth a quarter of what it was." And then they say to you, "Spare parts," and then you say, "Please reduce the premium." And they say, "Why don't you go and get a quote from somewhere else, and we will see if we can beat it? Because we really value your custom." At that point, you go and get the other quote, accept it, and cancel the existing relationship, I would think, because it's that sort of practice that has to stop.
Yeah, well, when I did cancel my last at one car and household, they wanted to actually cut it below what the other competitive quote I'd got was, and I said no, because I'm annoyed with you now. And I was told, because as I do the boss lady was like, "This is going to happen to you wherever you go." And I said, "Not again, it won't." Just keep switching. Because that's what their business model actually teaches you to do. You know, to keep shopping around and either switch or say, you know, "I'm switching if you don't lower." Because, yeah, that's the business. And clearly the model works because there are enough people that don't challenge it and just keep on paying and not finding out what the competitive rates, premiums, whatever are. And they just keep paying, believing that that's the going rate, you know. So, yeah, you don't ask, you don't get. That's the moral of the story, yeah.
I think you're absolutely right, Wendy Nola. Thank you, Wendy Nola, on the line to us this evening. Not a great phone line, but there's the lesson. And it's something we've discussed in the past, and I've promised that I'm going to be reviewing my stuff. A couple of years ago, I did review my insurances, and you just go, hold on a second. Hold on a second. Who's being the sucker here? How on earth did I get myself into a position where for years I've been paying X premium when, in fact, I should be paying Y or Z? And you've got to review the stuff. And it's only you who is going to look after your own interests. And Wendy Nola. Wendy Nola's going to look after your interests too, but you can't look after everybody's interests. And it's diabolical. When you go and you complain, it's, oh, no, we'll downgrade you. It's fine. Don't worry. So you were paying 322. Yeah, the rate is 190, but you didn't ask. Don't ask, don't get is the philosophy. And I'm afraid it is the burden of responsibility sits with you. After Eyewitness News, the chairman at IG Market South Africa, Ndabe Mkize, is our shape shifter. Looking forward to catching up with Ndabe this evening here on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Tonight's shapeshifter is Ndabe Mkize, who's chairman at IG Markets South Africa. He's got a list of degrees longer than your longest arm. But essentially, I mean, you're an actuary, right, Ndabe? But if we're going to summarize everything and distill it all down to everything, you're really trained as an actuary. That's where it all started.
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, I did actuarial science at the University of Cape Town. And worked for Old Mutual in the actuarial field for a number of years, and then moved into investment management, but moved more towards CFA and CAIA, which basically deals with traditional asset management as well as alternative asset management.
What was it about? What was it about actuarial science that appealed to you? A number of people love this idea of actuarial science. They're very good at it, and they build enormous careers and, in some cases, businesses out of the discipline of actuarial science. So you were a very disciplined individual, because it feels like hell on ice for those of us who are not actuarially minded.
I heard about it when I studied at high school, and obviously the attraction of doing something different and doing something that is difficult and something where there were very few black people who were going into it appealed to me. My dad actually wanted me to be a medical doctor, and I guess in this COVID-19 environment, we need all the doctors we can have. But we had no black actuaries before 1994. So to use my skills to go into a field that is difficult and to do something that would also blaze the trail for those who would follow behind appealed to me. So I embarked on the degree, and it was very good. I'm not a qualified actuary, but I went through the exams and then moved more to asset management. But certainly the experience of working there and the risk management rigor and really being able to think outside of the box and challenge my paradigms was very good.
Do you regret not going into medicine? I mean, a lot of people who go into medicine do regret it. It's messy, and it's people are very needy. a lot of people have medicine as a calling. Clearly, it wasn't your calling back then. But when you look back, do you have any regrets making the choices that you made?
I actually don't. I think the choice I made will probably in the future allow me to play a meaningful role in healthcare by bringing the appropriate investment, by building hospitals and funding people who are building hospitals. So one can actually play a meaningful role in the healthcare system as opposed to being a professional, although one cannot run a hospital without those professionals. So I think for me, given my disposition and the fact that I tend to be versatile in being able to do a number of things, the position that I'm in and the training that I got put me in good stead.
Talk to me about going into managing money, portfolio management. I mean, I think that first sort of venture out of actuarial science was into property management, wasn't it? I mean, I think that was the first experience of getting into managing assets.
Yes, I actually left Old Mutual and I joined Prudential Investment Managers. It was actually called Prudential Portfolio Managers back in 2003. And I started covering normal equities, retail stocks. That was very, very good. It was then followed by a move to Coronation Fund Managers in 2005. Where I was in the absolute return team covering both equities as well as listed property. Back in 2005, property was a little known asset class that quickly started doing very well. So the returns, they made everyone pay attention. And I was there at the right time before it became really big. And I've covered it through various roles, even as I've progressed to more high-level roles. So it was actually very good to move to asset management. And if I just think back at my role on the actuarial side of things, especially in actuarial finance, where we'd be looking at embedded values and looking at changes to those embedded values, which is a measure of how well an insurance company is doing, it was clear that the mortality profits and the changes in expenses do not really explain a lot of the changes in embedded value earnings. It was actually investment returns. So I figured that if I'm to make a difference to the policyholders' lives, I need to be getting the investment returns well. So moving into the investment area, which was still very rarefied, there were still very few black investment professionals, let alone those who are CFA charter holders or CAIA charter holders. It appealed to me, and I've loved it since then. Even though as time goes on, becoming a portfolio manager, becoming a deputy chief investment officer, and now chief investment officer, and looking at more non-executive roles, especially at IG when I'm chairman, I still have to follow those asset classes and see how they are doing and see the difference that they can make in whoever is investing or in a pension fund setting, whatever the case might be.
His day job is as Chief Investment Officer at Eskom, as Ndabe Mkhize has just told us. He's also Chair of IG Markets and looking to expand his horizons on from a non-executive point of view. But we'll talk more about Eskom in just a moment, because not the most popular place in South Africa right now. Not your fault, Ndabe. I'm not too sure whether you're a dab hand with a screwdriver and can fix a leak in a boiler, but that's not the job. Your job is as Chief Investment Officer at Eskom. We'll talk about that in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Unpacking data-driven insights and analysis to turn numbers into tangible business solutions at this year's Absa Beyond the Budget Dialogue. Now that's Africanacity. Apps as a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Tonight, Shapeshifters worked in a lot of places, including Stanlib and Coronation, also in the Healthcare Property Fund, and then made a leap into the SOE sector, where he is today, Chief Investment Officer at Eskom. Ndabe Mkhize is the Chief Investment Officer at Eskom. He's also Chairman at IG Markets South Africa. Talk to me about that shift from private to public sector, Ndabe. What was the appeal?
Bruce, the appeal was the work I was going to do. It's very easy for people to follow brands, and there are plenty of brands in asset management, and I'd worked for a number of them. It had given me credibility, and not only credibility, but very tangible skills. But what I wanted to do was to actually be able to get the platform to be able to manage not only money, but to also manage people and to manage projects. That's a skill set that you don't usually get in your typical asset management firm. You're either an analyst or a portfolio manager, and you can remain a PM for a very long time without managing people and being good at it and managing projects successfully. I believe that that opportunity to move into EPPF gave me the opportunity to be able to manage all three. I also believe that these institutions, be they public or pensions, they actually need to have very good people working for them, because indeed we are working for more than 80,000 people or members that we have, or a large number of people are affected by it. So the decisions we make need to be made by people with skill, people with integrity, and where you actually have that that scope to be able to bring to bear your experience and expertise. So that what was appealing to me, and I've been able to get that. And I think the exposure to various things, to business, not only in South Africa, but internationally, dealing with international asset managers, as well as in the rest of Africa, the ability to deal with not only listed markets, but also private markets because of our influence in what we allocate to, is actually what has made me a better manager of many people and projects, but also has elevated the stature such that you can have the likes of IG Markets South Africa seeing that there's some value that one can add, especially in the areas of governance. I'm also, if I can just mention in passing, that I'm also a chairman of the Audit and Risk Committee of the JSE-listed Fairvest Property Fund. So all of those things, I think they are bred in an environment where you're given a lot of scope to actually do things. So even though maybe the brand might not have been as highly placed as other asset managers, you know, back in 2014, but I think the work that we've done speaks for itself, and the fact that international firms are looking to us for leadership means that there's a lot that we can offer.
Talk to me about the brand Eskom. I mean, your association, you've progressed through the ranks of asset management in South Africa with some very well-known and very well-respected brands. Eskom doesn't strike me as one of those companies that when you put it on your CV necessarily is going to count massively in your favor one day.
I would not be an authority to speak on the Eskom brand per se. The only thing
it's your association with the brand. I mean, that's that. Yes. And it's clearly you're comfortable. And I'm curious as to why you are.
Yes. I think they ebb and flow, it depends on what people are doing. We certainly, where I am, are doing the right things in investments. We are very highly regarded by the asset managers that we interrogate before we give assets to. So in this space, especially in institutional investments, it's more the on-the-ground presence that you have. So I believe it's been very strong, it's been very good. And I think the proof of the pudding is the fact that you are having, as I said, international companies and JSE-listed companies that can actually look at the CV behind and be able to see what is being said. And I think the fact that we are also able to be thought leaders in various things in the space means that when you actually have the right people in place, it can transform an organization and take a brand from strength to strength.
What does running the investment management unit of the Eskom Pension and Provident Fund entail? There's $10 billion worth of assets. It's a huge pool of assets, and it's your responsibility in there to allocate those funds to the best asset managers that you are able to source locally and internationally. I mean, it's an enormous responsibility.
It's very humbling because you are dealing with people's livelihoods. One's pension is the largest or the second largest asset that a person would have. So it certainly needs a duty of care and a duty of skill, and to do that as independently as possible. So the way that we look at it is to focus on our liabilities, the promises that we make to pay pension to our members and to have the appropriate increases over time. So that focuses our minds. We have a more liability-driven focus or investment style following an asset liability modeling. So when we get down to allocating money to various asset managers, it is after we've gone through a very robust process of setting a long-term investment strategy, which is approved by various people, fund actuary, ALM actuary, and finally has to also be accepted by the regulator. And then having put that investment strategy, we then have to populate it with asset managers, both active and passive, and try by all means to make sure that they can beat those benchmarks so that we can have the best returns over a long period of time. When you have COVID-19, it puts all of those processes under strain. When you have steady hands at the tiller, it is easy to be able to ride out the storms as we have been able to do so.
Talk to me about Brian Molefe, because he still owes the Eskom Pension and Provident Fund some money, doesn't he?
It's not an area that I deal with because I focus mainly
on investments. You don't want pension fund money being paid out illegally, which appears it was, and he's got a court order instructing him to pay back, I think, 11 out of 30 million that he claimed, and he wanted the rest, and the courts have said to him, give back 11 million. What is the position? I mean, surely it's a topic of discussion. He's been at the Zondo Commission fairly recently.
Yes, I do believe that the best thing would actually be talk to people who are authorized to speak authoritatively on that. But I would say that we made sure that there is no money or the pension fund was never out of pocket. So we know exactly what happened, but I think the important thing is that the pension fund was never out of pocket. And that has been thoroughly tested. The processes are underway, as you've mentioned, the court case. But I think for this evening, it is more proper to talk to the people who are more appropriate for it.
I mean, Eskom is a massive employer. It's going to become a smaller employer into the future. There's no way that Eskom can sustain its headcount. I mean, the responsibility on you as Chief Investment Officer to make sure that the people who no longer work for Eskom in the future are looked after is enormous. I mean, that's the real pressure here.
And that's why we make sure that the assets are sufficient to cover the liabilities, the promises we make. We have a very good funding ratio of 135%. What that means is when you take our assets, about $10 billion or call it 165 billion rands, and you divide it by the assets that we have 35% more assets to actually put as a surplus. So that makes us in a very strong position to back those promises that we have made. And it's a very important statement because we believe that we are probably the one of the best funded pension funds in South Africa and one of the best in the world. We have to because we don't have a balance sheet to really fall back on or it's not as strong. But nonetheless, I think it just goes to show the seriousness with which we take our job of ensuring that we have enough assets to meet our liabilities as they fall due and to ensure that we attract the right caliber of people to be able to manage our money and to look after our pensioners.
Ndabe Mkize, it's a big job. Thank you very much indeed for coming, telling us about it. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Eskom. Get the results from your business once with a winning employee benefits formula from Momentum Corporate, working in partnership with you. They will apply their deep insights into the science of employee benefits to formulate your evidence-based solution. The result will be employees who feel appreciated, protected, and invested in the success of your business. Momentum Corporate, success is a science.